This is just a little foreword before you listen to the episode. A couple things. Firstly, my guest, Sam Clouston, he's been a friend of mine for about 4 years. This may be intimidating to some people who want to come on the show and talk about their own experiences, because myself and Sam are very, very open and we talk in depth about our problems. This to some is kind of how a healthy relationship can look in terms of talking about mental health in an open and comfortable environment. But again, if you wanted to come onto the show and talk to me, please note that it doesn't have to be like this. This is just a very, very like the extreme end of the spectrum in terms of being extremely open. So don't be alarmed. Also, there was a lot in this episode. We spoke for about 3 hours, so I've actually cut the first hour and a half out because it wasn't really on the right topic. But I will be putting it into its own episode, probably a 2.5. In that particular segment, we spoke about drugs, relationships, sex, friendship groups, like growing up, being in your 20s. It's quite insightful still, and it's less about personal experience, but it's about sort of general well-being in your 20s, and I think it's quite an interesting segment to put into its own episode, so I will put it in a follow-up episode after this. But yeah, okay, listen at your own risk, because it is quite heavy, this particular episode. And again, like I said, we are very open. Also, last thing to mention, I had just had my big panic attack just before the recording of this, so I did speak very quickly. And you can definitely hear it in my voice that I'm still a little bit on edge. So apologies for the sort of jittery nature of this recording. Listening back's quite embarrassing, actually. Like, listening to my voice, it's a bit like, fucking hell, is that how I sound? But I was still quite anxious, so I speak really quick. And I'm very much like this. Very much like speaking so quick. That's just, I don't know. That's not normal for me. I do speak quickly, but You can definitely hear the anxiety in my voice, so apologies in advance. Anyway, with that being said, I'm going to play my intro now and go straight into this. This is a long one. Good luck and enjoy. But look, anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to go on a massive, been a complete binge, mate. I just haven't even asked you about you, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but as you said, this is a conversation.
I know, mate, I just...
This is essentially me and you not seeing each other for 4 months and having a conversation, and it just happens that there's a microphone on.
Yeah, I just, I've got this guilty conscience in the back of my chest feeling where I'm like, wow, people are going to be like, they're not talking about panic attacks. What are they doing? That I'm really fearful of that. I'm fearful people are going to now tune in and be like, hey, Josh, where's the anxiety, guys?
I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I'm sure you know this as well, but I think it's always useful at the beginning to record something later and to just basically describe the course of the podcast.
I can do a little intro.
Yeah.
I can say, hey, guys, this week...
This was the first one.
Yeah.
It took us a while to settle down. We hadn't seen each other for 4 months.
And that was the point,
though. There's a lot of catching up to do. And, you know, in the second half of the program or the podcast... is when we really got into
you're a genius. That's a great idea. I didn't think about that. It's because I went to like one take all the way through, but yeah. I think
there's nothing wrong with doing an intro, and you should do your intro on Hove Lawns on a sunny day, just on your phone or something.
But I can do it in my studio at home.
You can do it wherever.
Yeah, to be fair, I'll work it out.
Because I always listen to this one podcaster called Adam Buxton, okay. And he always does his intro while he's walking his dog.
That's a sick idea,
quite peaceful.
I like that. That's good.
But the quality is not as good.
Oh, well, that's a shame. I like my mic at home because it's quite soothing, like a narrator's voice.
The gaming mic.
Yeah, but that's actually a good mic. It's actually a good mic. But like, yeah, so I think, how are you feeling this morning, though? Is it still the morning? Yeah, we still got morning. Yes, yeah, this case needs
1 minute, yeah.
How's your morning?
Good.
So you didn't sleep very well?
Well, I didn't sleep badly. I just woke up a few times.
Mm.
I think I ate too much before bed.
Yeah,
I watched quite an exciting film before bed.
You watch?
1917.
Oh, very dark.
I watched it in the cinema, and then me and my girlfriend watched it last night on a huge projector at home. Nice. So it gets the blood pumping.
Oh, immersion.
Yeah, I
like that.
I'm all about immersion.
Yeah, same.
Gets the blood pumping.
Yeah. Not a bad thing.
So, but sometimes before bed, it can affect your sleep
massively, mate. Massively.
That's our generation's biggest problem.
Yeah,
is that our parents turn their phone off an hour before they go to bed, mm-hmm. and then they read a book.
Yeah,
we do not do that.
I do read sometimes, but I struggle.
Yeah, exactly.
Get a couple of pages and it's like once a week.
If we're being frank, a lot of people watch porn before they go to bed.
Yeah.
You're still on your phone. Yeah. You're still being exposed to the light.
Entirely. And also, like, reading, so we're in a generation where, in an age now where there's so much to do that you just you can't switch off sometimes. Yeah. It is hard. Would you say the quarantine was tough for you as well, like going back? Because I know, let's kind of talk. I don't want to, again, this is not even like an interview format, because I just want to talk to you about it anyway.
Yeah.
But like, you know, because you've, you know, we can obviously be open about what you've gone through if you want to. Like, because you've had a hard time. And
I'm not sure whether it will trigger some response in me today.
Yeah.
But I don't think it will trigger anything significant enough that I'd have to stop talking about it.
Okay. Do you feel safe?
Yeah, no, I feel fine. It's just
good.
The last few months have been very different. It's like my mental health entered a different phase that it's never been in before.
It's very relatable.
And therefore, it's still quite new territory for me.
It's very relatable to me as well. I feel that. I think quarantine was the first time I sat down with myself for so long.
This is the first time in the last... I mean, I've had agoraphobia, for those who didn't know I had... I've had it technically probably since I was 14, but it never really came out until I was 21.
There's a big stigma with that, because people just think it's you can't leave your house. Yeah. There's so much more to it, mate. There's so much more to it.
Or it's being scared of fields or something.
So I told my dad, I was like, I've got Sam on the show. And he was like, what's he got?
Yeah.
He didn't say that.
You love dads. Yeah, you love dads.
He wasn't that bad. My dad doesn't speak like that. But he was like, so, you know, what are you going to be talking about? And I was like, Sam's got, you know, agoraphobia. And he was like, oh, what's that? I was like, it's hard to explain. But he was like, is it like when you can't leave your room? And I was like, maybe this is the problem, because that term is, I mean, people just throw that term around for like random shit. Yeah. And it's like, you know, how would you describe it?
It's a general term to a variety of manifestations of mental illness. Agoraphobia is a type of a disorder. So agoraphobia is actually not really a medical term.
Oh.
So it's like a symptom term, if that makes sense.
So the
mental illness that I have is called panic disorder.
Okay, so that's what it's classed under, yeah.
Yeah, so agoraphobia is a specific type of panic disorder. Agoraphobia itself is not under the DSM-50, which is the mental health classification system.
Because I guess in health anxiety comes under panic disorder as well, so it's like they all kind of filter.
Exactly, and agoraphobia and health anxiety are nearly exactly the same. Mm-hmm. They just manifest in different ways. And actually, I don't know if I've told you this, but me and my mum worked out that my agoraphobia stems from health anxiety.
That's so fucking fascinating.
Yeah, and they appear to have nothing to do with each other, but I'll explain how it developed. And it completely comes from health anxiety.
When did your health anxiety start? Were you young?
So there's a few contributing factors from when I was a kid. So I was just a nervous kid.
Yeah.
It's my personality. My dad...
But it comes from your parents though, right?
Yeah. So my mum is a very relaxed person. Mm-hmm. My dad, bless him, he's going to listen to this. He won't mind me saying this.
Sorry, Dad.
My dad is a bit more of a warrior. Mm-hmm. That's all I'll say. And he had a bit of a rough time growing up himself. I don't know. He had some horrible things happen to him in his life. I don't know how much that affect how his worrying is. And I don't think that he had a massive effect on my worrying either.
Sure.
But I think all I'm saying is I think genetically that's where I got the nervousness from. Not from my mum. Maybe from my mum a bit as well. Because my sister has it too.
Okay.
And then growing up... what I'm trying to say though is my dad didn't do anything to make me nervous. I think he's genetically like that, and the rest of his family.
Same
like
my
that.
Parents, mate. Yeah. I think my dad runs the in families. Sort of thing. He had tough life, and he never. I think a lot of in that generation as well, addressing those problems is a lot harder than it is now.
Exactly. And my mum had cancer when I was younger.
Well, I never knew that.
Yeah, she had breast cancer. It was. I don't know the stages of the cancer, but it was the second stage, so it was sort of like medium cancer. So she caught it early, got it removed.
Sure.
There was no complications.
Okay.
She's recovered. She's cancer free.
Okay, that's great news.
But as a 6-year-old, you do not understand that. Not and you don't really understand. The thing that's weird.
Do you understand the concept of cancer? Or?
Well, I don't know. I don't think I understood any of it. I don't think you understand death at that
age. So was it a scary thing? Was it more like an inquisitive thing?
No, it was a scary thing. Yeah. And the the thing that was scary about it is that my mum disappeared to hospital for a few weeks. And as a child who sees their mother every day, it's like they've died, basically. And I knew something was wrong because all my mum's hair fell out and all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Anyway, mum recovered.
Yeah.
And everything goes back to normal. But I think that just sort of...
creates a little bit of a...
created some sort of, like, worry.
100%.
About... and actually, so you were 6 years old. I was introduced...
6 years old?
Yeah.
See, that to me, honestly, mate, there's a correlation. Bad age. There's a correlation with 6 years old. That happened to me as well. Not the same thing, but being similar 6 years old, there was a big correlation. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
It's a bad age to experience something like that. And I think what I might... again, I don't want to be an armchair psychologist, but I think what it might have done is expose me to death a little bit earlier than I should have been.
Understandable, yeah.
And, you know, you watch a few scary films and that around that age. Anyway, jump forward to when I was 14. I had a very, very disruptive year, basically, when I was 14. And I had got in trouble with the police. I was attacked and had fights with people. Mm-hmm. I was like basically hunted down by someone. It sounds dramatic.
No, it's not dramatic.
But as an adult, you look at it and be like, it's minor. But when you're a kid, it really does feel
real.
Those
things are more than real, mate.
Yeah. And it all stemmed from an argument originating with my best mate at the time who, you know, that's what kids do. But it all got too much. And
you still friends with him?
Oh, friendly with him. Like, we made up later we're very good friends. The only reason we're not best friends now is because I live in a different city.
Yeah, you drifted.
Yeah, it's nothing to do with that. But we fell out big time and lots of other people got involved. And I was at people were chasing me down the street with baseball bats and stuff
That's pretty dark.
And I hung out on big estates with pretty scary criminals. And all sorts of horrible sort of stuff happening.
Yeah.
Very scary people, not knives and guns, but
it just wasn't
there was a fear.
Yeah.
A danger. And I come from a very sort of loving, peaceful household, family, and none of that is a thing. So alarm bells are definitely ringing. And this whole time I was smoking weed for the first time as a 14-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And where I'm from, it's next level.
Yeah.
Like the stuff you're smoking up there is mad.
Yeah.
Strong. Anyway, had a really, really, really bad experience with a particular joint I smoked once.
Can I just pause you?
Yeah.
This story has been said so many times in terms of I smoked a joint and.
Yeah.
Because so many people
have had it.
Because I think. Okay, carry on, but then I want to just interject after with a little thing to say. Sorry.
Well, it's the thing that's interesting about this is for a long time, I thought this was what caused this.
There we go. Okay, so I have to just interject now because I have to just say it because it's honestly so fascinating because, mate, I had something similar when I was in Bristol for uni when I smoked a joint and I got really fucking high and I started to panic because my body wasn't used to those sensations. Now, what it is, people always think the weed is what causes it or a bit of MD or a bit of cocaine, but really these sensations that you get from drugs, including alcohol, makes your body feel a certain way. We're not used to it. So the mind goes, hold on, danger, not used to this. What's that? You get high, your heart rate kind of slows down and you get really spaced out and everything starts to become a bit you get a bit mellow. Yeah, yeah. You start to panic, what's wrong with me? Something's going wrong. I don't feel right. Trigger, panic, you're panicking, adrenaline's flowing.
And at that age, you don't know how to stop it. Yeah. So it goes on for
ages. Then after you sober up, just hit my mic, sorry. After you sober up, you have that kind of derealization, depersonalization feeling because the adrenaline's been moving and you were high, so you're kind of hungover almost. And then you think, oh my God, I'm permanently damaged from that joint. Yeah. Sorry, I had to interject because so many people in my life have said that. And they're like, no, my anxiety, it was this joint that I smoked. And it's like, was it the joint that caused the anxiety? That didn't start the anxiety. That just revealed that you have... That didn't... If you smoked that joint or not, you would have experienced that panic attack at some point in your life and been just as scared. But it's just a matter of when.
It's just the match.
What triggers it. Yeah. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I had to just jump in and say that because it's so interesting. Sorry, mate. Yeah.
Yeah. So around that time, I this might take a while to explain, but the real bulk of it is at the beginning and then it develops.
Cool.
So around the same time.
I never knew. Can I say it's actually interesting for me as well, because we've only like touched on the surface of this before, so it's quite like it's nice to be in depth. Anyway, carry on. Finally, yeah. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, yeah. So around the same time, I discovered I had an allergy to Brazil nuts.
Mad.
So I'm allergic to Brazil nuts.
Fair enough.
And if I eat one, I will have to go to A&E straight away.
Well, is it like a serious allergy?
Yeah, it's very. I'll die in about 10 minutes.
Wow, really?
It's a very serious anaphylactic shock. It might have changed since I was 14, because I haven't actually had one since I was 14. Oh, yeah, but at that point, within about 3 minutes, my throat had closed up. So
do you know what? That is some scary shit.
Yeah. So imagine in the same month, you have this out-of-body drug experience as a 14-year-old, at the same time as being constantly threatened by people chasing down the street as baby boy. And then you get rushed to A&E because you almost die of a Brazil nut. And your brain, your 14-year-old brain, not an adult would find that stressful, but probably be able to move on from it. The problem is with my age. So your brain is not fully developed and therefore connections haven't been made yet, and they get made in the wrong way. So my brain just overloaded, basically. Mm-hmm. And that connection was permanently made.
Yeah.
Well, not permanently, because let's be optimistic.
Yeah.
You can change this.
Of course
stuff.
You can. Of course you can, mate.
Bit of a lobotomy, have a little move around in there. But yeah, some jump was made at that point. And it was just too much. But the really interesting thing I find from a sort of like, oh, that's interesting perspective, is that this did not manifest until years later. But the seeds were sown then.
Yeah.
So quite soon after that, you know, when you're a kid, you have no concept of death. I don't think. I mean, you know what it is, but you don't actually realise what it is.
I don't know, though, because some people were very afraid of death at that age, still, as kids. I had a friend who was very anxious about dying every night he went to sleep.
Yeah.
So I guess...
But I feel like they're not afraid of dying. And this is just me, from my own opinion. Yeah. You can take this with a pinch of salt.
Yeah.
They're afraid of something else. I just don't think that anyone really knows what death is at that age, really understands... Other than the primal fear. So maybe it was, maybe it's the primal fear of death, which is what makes us, you know, not go like that when we touch a hot surface. Jump out the way of a car. Yeah. That fear, then yeah, probably is. So ignore what I've just said.
It's okay.
But
don't worry.
I didn't really understand what death was.
Understandably.
You know, you watch films, people die.
But you don't think about it.
You know, your grandma died when she was young. You don't think about it.
Yeah.
It doesn't affect me. Mm-hmm. I'm 14.
Yeah.
My whole life ahead of me.
I'm a kid.
Death is not, obviously, I'm not going to die at any point in my life. I'm never going to die. I'm going to live forever. And then, you know, get rushed to hospital and...
It hits you.
The doctor's like, no, maybe not the doctor, but you're just like, you were about to die. Mm. And if I'd been home alone or something, luckily the hospital's 2 minutes around the corner. That is crucial, by the way. Very crucial. The hospital's around the corner. That will be where agoraphobia starts to develop. So, can you see where it's going to come from?
And also, I can see it now, right now.
So, I live around the corner from the hospital. Literally, it's like a 2-minute drive. So, I ate the Brazil nut. We were already aware of my allergy. It got worse. So, when I was a child, I had a Brazil nut allergy and it just made me throw up.
And it got worse and worse as you got older.
So, I had another one. The ironic thing is that I was going on holiday with a school trip. And my mum and dad were like, my mum and dad both had allergies as kids that disappeared when they hit puberty. Mm-hmm. And the last time I'd eaten Brazil nut when I was about 9 and I was 14. So my mum and dad were like, okay, we're going to give you a tiny weeny bit of a Brazil nut because it all just made me sick. And they were like, hopefully you'll realize that you've lost your allergy. For some fucking stupid 14-year-old teenage idiot reason, I ate the whole thing.
Oh, mate.
Because I wasn't listening to what they were saying. They said, cut off a tiny bit and just put it on your tongue. I ate the whole thing in one go. That's why I had such a severe reaction.
Yeah.
And anyway, rushed to hospital, sorted out, you know, back to school in a couple of days. And then quite soon after that, the weed and the threatening thing, I stopped smoking weed after that, and the beef I was having with these kids ended quite soon after. So those triggers did go away.
Mm-hmm.
But I think them all happening at the same time was what caused this thing to let it develop. Anyway, so after that, I started to think quite a lot about what could kill me, as in what could cause my death. I wasn't scared of being murdered or anything. I really became aware of how weak my body was.
Okay. And wow, that word weak. Ooh.
Yeah. And like ouch. How you really do think you're indestructible and then you realize you eat a nut and you can just die like that.
It's massively scary.
Yeah. And then I got obsessed with like strokes and stuff. I kept thinking I was going to get a stroke. Like I'd have a headache and I'd
be like, oh, and here comes the health anxiety.
Yeah. So it developed over time into this health anxiety.
Oh, man. How horrible is that? You can feel it when it develops as well. Yeah. Every day it's like something new.
I was watching Skins
Trigger
Series 2, I think, and Tony gets hit by a bus.
And you get triggered like, wow, this is it. Yeah. Gonna, this is going to happen to me.
Tony got hit by a bus. And you're so impressionable at that age.
Spoilers, by the way.
Yeah, gets hit.
It was actually
bus.
End of season one.
Oh, end of season Sorry. One. And then season two, yeah, he has what is essentially a stroke.
He was like a dickhead in season one, right? And he was like, he was a prig. Yeah. And then suddenly
he gets reset.
Yeah, and he was like really there and he was like confessing his love to Effie.
Yeah. No, that's his sister.
Oh, yeah, sorry. That's really awkward. Yeah. It was, what's her name? It's Michelle. Yeah. And he gets hit by the bus. And then the next season, he's like really permanently damaged until the end of the season. Yeah. I remember. Sorry. And, tangent.
Yeah. And
good show.
I was just obviously impressionable at that age. So I started reading about that sort of stuff. And I was
like in-depth for like a couple, like couple Google
in-depth
searches.
Reading. Okay, and, you know, this is also a first time where, you know, you start to really feel emotions really strongly around that age. Anyway, so I became obsessed with that for a while. And so the only thing that made me feel comfortable about this was the fact that there was a hospital around the corner. So I always went...
This is such an interesting correlation.
It is really... I found... Look, because me and my mum only worked it out a year ago and I've had it for 10
Madness.
Years. Yeah, we only worked out where it came from because we always thought that smoking a joint just caused some spark and then I had agoraphobia.
As we know now...
It's a very subtle path of events. So I always thought, well, the way that I got comfort and actually I got over the health anxiety. I do not have health anxiety now. I have not had health anxiety since I was 15, 16.
So you don't get any little...
I don't worry. Like if I get like a problem with my body, I mean, I'm normal level hypochondriac as in like, you know, if, when you smoke, for example, you get like chest pains, you're like, ooh, but it doesn't worry me. It doesn't keep me up at night. Do you know what I mean? Like if I have a headache, I'm not worried.
Yeah.
I check myself for lumps. I'm not worried. I'm fine.
Yeah, cool.
So the way that I would relax myself is be like, okay, well, worst thing comes to worst. If I have a stroke...
Hospital's around the corner.
Yeah. So that's all fine and dandy. And then the first time in a year after that, I go on holiday.
Right.
And I go on a holiday to somewhere pretty rural.
Okay.
And it didn't occur to me. And then when I got there, I sort of said to my mum, where's the nearest hospital? And she went, oh, it's probably about 25 miles away. And you have to get on a boat, which is only runs from 9 to 5. Mate. Because my mum had no idea. She was like, you know, we can only get it from 9 to 5 in the morning. So I sort of went, so if I eat a Brazil nut at 6 o'clock in the afternoon,
I'm gonna die.
I will die.
Can you not get like EpiPen? Oh, sorry, is that
the
right thing?
EpiPens do not, they just put off the reaction for 10 minutes.
So how do you cure a reaction to a Brazil nut?
If you have a severe one, you need to take the same stuff as hay fever tablets, actually.
So like,
cetirizine.
So you have to go to the hospital, but why the hospital? Why can't you, can you not do anything from home if you have these kind of severe
effects? Well, if you, so
stupid
like a
question,
normal,
I'm just
no, it's fine,
now.
It's fine. It's a normal reaction to anything like hay fever or dust or mold or, you know, if you're allergic to something and it just makes you sick is... you take an antihistamine, which is like cetirizine or loratadine or something. Okay. And that basically what happens when you have an allergy is your certain parts of your body enlarge.
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the reason you get hay fever is because your eyes enlarge and your nose and you need to sneeze and you get a sore throat because everything just swells basically.
Yeah. I can hear that pipe running through the room. Can you hear it?
No, I can't.
It's like really horrible. It sounds like someone's having a wee. No one's weeing next to us, by the way.
I can't hear anything.
Carry on.
And when, so even if I ate Brazil nut now, I think I need to be retrained on it, really.
Okay.
I need to take a antihistamine. Mm-hmm. and using the EpiPen. So an EpiPen keeps you alive.
Okay.
So EpiPens do not stop the allergic reaction at all. They've got nothing to do with it.
Okay.
They just make sure your heart doesn't stop.
Okay. So when you go to hospital,
will, if you have a severe allergic reaction, and your body will shut down. The only thing EpiPen does is make sure you don't die.
Okay, I'm with
because
you.
Because it just keeps your blood
pumping.
So
you have to go to hospital. There's no other way.
I would have to go to hospital,
okay,
yeah.
Cool.
So because they need to give you steroids and other
that's
things.
It. Okay, that's interesting.
Which you can't get over the counter.
That makes sense.
You can't
get
a prescription either.
So your mum's telling
and
you...
And they need to put you on a drip and stuff. It's quite serious.
Yeah, it's pretty scary. Some scary
shit. So anyway, my mum goes, you know, there's no hospital anywhere near here. That's the beauty of it. We're not in a town.
Oh, God.
You can really see where agoraphobia
alarm,
is coming
alarm
in
bell's
now.
Going off now. Yeah. The kill bill alarm's happening now.
So at this point, I'm 15. And so I sort of say to my mum, you know, well, what if I actually say it out loud for the first time, what if I ate a Brazil nut and had an allergic reaction? Because she's my mum, she said, oh, you'll be fine. You know, we'll give you the EpiPen, we'll take the things. And that sort of went, oh, okay. I should be fine then. And then I get into bed at night, that night, the first night of the holiday, and I'm just thinking about it a bit more than I thought I would be thinking about it. And my mum really has settled it, like my mood. There's no panic involved. It's just normal worry, you know, as worried as you would be about missing a train.
Okay.
I mean? But then at night, I'm sitting there and going, you know, really, really, if I get into the nitty gritty of this, would that save my life?
So you start going into detail.
Yeah. And then that just slowly develops. You know, I get through the holiday. I'm incredibly lucky because Brazil nuts are literally in nothing other than packets of Brazil nuts and muesli.
Really?
Have you ever seen a Brazil nut in anything? They don't use it. It's not used for cooking.
Yeah, not really.
It's not used in anything other than breakfast cereal and packets of Brazil nuts.
Yeah.
So I've never come across them ever since.
Okay, that's cool.
Whenever I go to a restaurant, I say, can you check? But it's never in anything. Not in any cuisine, even Brazilian cuisine, which is where the problem's not in it.
Madness. Okay.
It's because it's not the right type of food, I think.
Sure, okay.
And anyway, I think that just developed.
Right.
So, you know, next year I drove up to Manchester, and when I was in London, fine. When I was in Manchester, fine. Big city. Even
hospital.
A 15-year-old knows. There's lots of hospitals around. So.
What an interesting correlation.
That's good. On the motorway there and back.
Not good.
Nowhere near a hospital.
What if something happens?
And at that point, I'm still like, what if we're in a car crash? We're not near a hospital, blah, 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 blah,
Your
blah,
whole
blah.
Life is a fear at the moment.
Yeah. So at this point, and the only way I'm getting through it is by playing Angry Birds intensively on my
distracting
phone
yourself,
for 4 hours, which is quite a long trip. And just feeling the physical feeling in this car. This was one of the first times, I think, that it really started to physically feel like something. Yeah. And I was in this car and it just felt like I was about to take off into the sky. Like it felt like I had a rocket underneath me.
Yeah.
And I would just you literally
seat, like,
hold
car.
On to the sides
I've
of
been
your
there.
Seats.
I've
yeah.
been there.
And just tension, so much tension. But
oh, it's horrible.
I didn't because I didn't know what it was, it almost was better that I didn't know what it was because I was just like, this is temporary. I don't know what's going on here, but clearly I'm just a bit out of sorts. Maybe I'm a bit ill or something.
Okay.
So I come back. I do my work experience at hospital in London. It's a series of unfortunate
events.
This
is like...
So I did my work experience. So that was the first time it got bad. The day I came back, I started my 2-week work experience on the mental health ward of the most... busy hospital in London, which is called Royal Free, which has the biggest mental health problems. So anyway, 2 weeks of completely traumatic work experience, which I wasn't supposed to be doing.
Right.
Someone pulled a favour.
Okay.
Full of people like, you know, standing in a room where a schizophrenic person has walked in and 10 nurses about to jump on him, stab him in the neck with a thing. And the thing is,
I thought that was just like in the film.
No,
that was actually
it's real.
I thought that was a...
If you need to restrain someone who is like... If there's a 6'5" man who believes all of those nurses are trying to kill him. The beautiful thing about that experience is it really showed me that schizophrenics are not dangerous.
No.
They are terrified.
Honestly, I always thought that was like a real over-exaggeration in films done to kind of like almost ruin the stigma, like enhance the stigma of mental health. Because you know, back in the day, like... the word insane and yeah. like, you know, being mentally ill. It's like a really bad connotation. Yeah. And I thought they were just kind of, I thought films were just kind of enhancing that.
In so certain situations, they are real. Like, if you need to restrain someone and there are no police with no handcuffs and no restraints,
yeah.
and there is a huge 6'5" man
yeah.
who is acting like an animal trapped yeah. in a corner.
Yeah. That's
that
really sad.
That person is incredibly difficult to control, and that person will attack you.
Yeah.
And that's where the idea of violence comes from. Mm-hmm. It's not that these people are psychopaths who want to, it's that they're scared animals, essentially, yeah. who are defending themselves.
Fight or flight, mate. Fight
and
or
they
flight.
Genuinely fight believe that those nurses sedating them are yeah. poisoning them. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that was quite interesting. It was also
very
probably quite traumatic. Anyway,
age.
That's not the point. The Royal Free is a 12-story building.
Okay.
And so I would go up to the 12th floor and I would look out the window and the floor underneath me would feel like I was on a boat.
Right.
And I was like, this is really weird. Something's going on here. And it was the same feeling I'd had in the car up to Manchester. And I was like, why is this not going away? Again.
Is something wrong with me?
Yeah. Again, didn't really realise. Anyway, after that summer, I went to a new school, 4th floor. It's not 12 floors, it's 4 floors. There's a big difference between 4 and 12 floors.
Yeah.
Started getting this on the 4th floor of my school building. And I was like, okay, what the fuck is going on? Something yeah. is happening here. So I decided to go to the doctor. And the doctor says, you've got anxiety.
Well, the doctor straight up just knew.
Yeah, well, I described my symptoms. Okay. I was like, I get palpitations.
Well, that's good, because a lot of doctors sometimes, they you know.
Well, one of my GPs completely dismissed me. So
yeah,
I
well,
if I went
yeah.
for another one, but he's yeah. a complete twat, and I don't yeah. mind saying he's a complete twat, because he missed my mum's cancer as well.
Wow, okay.
Like, arrogantly missed yeah, it. Okay. Was like, you've got nothing wrong with you. So she went to another doctor, and he was like, you've got a massive lump on your breast. Anyway, yeah, so.
4th floor, new school.
I've got to the end of, that was the whole development of agoraphobia. So it that's where it transformed. So by this point, no health anxiety.
Mm.
So it's for somehow it's gone from being close to urban areas
mm.
because they tend to have hospitals in them to, I don't really know where the height thing came from. I think
fear of heights is fear of heights.
Fear of heights, and maybe it just got merged in with that reaction at some point,
which probably enhanced it.
Yeah, which probably enhanced it. Anyway, next 2 years were all right. You know, I went on holiday mm-hmm. to France. Felt a bit uncomfortable, but
nothing out of the ordinary.
I could control it by, you know, reading a book or something, or okay. playing a game on my phone. You know, I wouldn't go up the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah,
but I would be in.
Don't do that, mate.
In
yeah.
Paris and be able to look around and
yeah.
All that and come back. And then my friends were like, oh, we want to go to Malia. And I was like, I don't want to go. I don't want to get on a plane.
Plane. Yeah. yeah.
Planes I've never liked.
I don't like planes.
I will
planes
not
much.
Be afraid to admit.
I was not, I liked them as a kid, but as I got older, I became quite afraid of getting on them. I think that it was more the claustrophobia rather than the height and the takeoff and landing, which kind of affected me the most.
Yeah.
That is a scare.
I won't talk about planes because that is one of my biggest triggers.
We won't talk about it.
Yeah. And not because of avoidance, but I would like to get onto the second half.
Yeah, let's go.
And I don't want to compromise it. And
let's not do it.
Me and planes is almost like a joke. Like, I just can't think about planes.
Let's not do it.
Anyway, I then took a year.
Friends are going Malia, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I took a year off, which was fine. Didn't have any problems with it.
So about 18, 19.
Yeah, and I wasn't going all around the country, but I was going around the country. I think a lot of this was an unfortunate pairing of events. So for some reason, for like 2 or 3 years, I just had no excuse to go anywhere. As in, I didn't go on holiday. My parents don't really go on holiday very much.
Okay.
And my only relatives up north are up north.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to see them, and I just didn't go and see them for 3 years. So I think the problem at that point was I unintentionally didn't push my boundaries at all.
So your comfort zone shrunk.
My comfort zone shrunk without me realising.
Yeah, we never realised.
By accident,
yeah.
I didn't leave London or the southeast of England for 3 years.
Okay.
Whilst this thing was bubbling in my brain under the surface. And
which has time to grow when your comfort zone is so small.
Yeah, exactly.
It grows quick.
And I was completely unaware of it.
It fucks you up.
Anyway.
Yeah.
My granddad lives in Horsham, which is only up the road from here.
Yeah.
Used to go all the time. Anyway, I applied for university, got a place at the University of Sussex. So me and my mum came to the open day.
Right.
On the train down, I was very hungover. I was quite anxious on the train.
That's a trigger in itself, isn't it?
But I was like, I'm fucking hungover. So no wonder I feel like this.
Yeah.
And
at least you can acknowledge that, because some people just won't even say that.
Yeah. We'll get onto my relationship with alcohol in a bit. Mm-hmm. Got on the train, loved it. Loved the uni. Had only been to Brighton as a kid and I fell in love with it.
Yeah.
And I am not ashamed to say that Brighton is my favourite place in the world. Yeah, and I have fallen in love with it. And
it's like a person, isn't it?
I have actually fallen in love with Brighton. And I smile to myself when I realise that I live here.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same as you actually, which is quite funny.
Yeah. Came to Sussex, had a great first year, loved walking on the downs, always felt a tiny bit on edge. Mm-hmm. We're talking 5% out of 100. I was really into photography, wildlife. So I used to go onto because Sussex University is in the South Downs.
Mm.
So you can just basically walk out your back door and you're in the middle of these huge, beautiful rolling hills. And that was great. And then in my first year in the summer, I came back to visit, went for a walk in the South Downs, had a absolutely massive panic attack.
Ooh.
One of the worst I've ever had. It's like one of those films where like the first is the worst.
It's like, was it one of those panic attacks where it's like, this is definitely the time I'm going to die now?
It was, but the thing is I'd read enough for a long time that I don't associate panic attacks with death.
Okay.
So I don't worry about dying. It's just purely animal instincts. Like there's a danger the weird thing with me is that I'm so well versed on it that I'm not scared of anything.
Yeah.
It's my body doing the thinking.
Sure.
Like I'm not thinking about anything really.
I'm with you.
And it wasn't one of those things that built up like, oh, this is getting worse. It just happened.
Okay.
And I don't know what I've been doing. Maybe I've been drinking too much or eating too much or drinking too much Diet Coke or some shit. And it was a mega panic attack. Actually, I forgot to say, one before that was coming back from Lewis over the Downs. That caused a big panic attack as well. Like an extreme panic attack where I almost broke my sister's hand. I'm not exaggerating.
Wow.
Because I was holding it that hard that she was like, in pain.
That's
and that was the first time my sister, mum and dad ever saw me. And they, but up to scary. That point, bless them, didn't really understand it.
Quite
and
ignorant to it. Not in a bad way, yeah. But just, you know.
And after that, they went, oh, shit, you've got something wrong with you.
Yeah.
And, severe panic attack. It lasted. And the difference is, I'd had small panics before and they lasted maybe about half an hour. And I'd been to CBT sessions and all right. the CBT people had said panic attacks do not last more than half an hour. So I was like, great.
Mm-hmm.
And this panic attack lasted 3-4 days. What I now know different panic attacks.
Yeah.
They're all caused by the same thing.
They keep triggering.
It's
like a reaction.
Which no one told me. So I thought, I've got a panic attack going for 4 days. Anyway,
that is where the fear develops for a lot of people because they have a panic attack and they don't know how to switch it off. So they come to their senses and then they have another one and another one and it lasts for days. And that's when people are like, I'm forever cursed. This is never going to go away. And people really lose their minds. That's really sad. Yeah. But sorry, there you go. Carry on.
Yeah. And actually now I live in a world where I'm not actually really, I don't think I'm really scared of hills or maybe I'm scared of heights, but I'm scared of panic attacks. That's what panic disorder is. You're scared of the panic attack. You're not scared really of the thing that's causing the panic attack. You eventually become scared of the panic attack because the panic attack is the scary thing.
So it's still a fear factor.
Yeah, it's a fear factor. But even though fear changes.
Even though you feel like you got to a point where you understand what they are and how they come on.
Yeah.
That's so fascinating.
Yeah.
I
think it's the interaction between the subconscious and the conscious brain. With the subconscious brain, you have zero control over.
Okay.
And the conscious brain makes up 90% of the mass of your brain.
Sure.
And the subconscious literally does 90% of the work.
Man, this.
And it's so small and so underdeveloped, essentially, that it's the same brain as a rabbit.
Yeah.
And if you fire a gun next to a rabbit, it will run away. If you fire a gun next to a rabbit 100 times, it will run away. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
So you don't have any control over it, basically. It's pure instinct. your only reason we're really here is to survive.
Yeah.
And that's my brain doing that. So anyway, went on medication after that, got it under control.
What were you on?
Oh, sorry, I forgot to say that after that massive one,
on the downs,
I came home to London, which is where I grew up, and it got to the point where I didn't leave the house for about 2 weeks. Luckily, I've got very supportive friends and family who are all really encouraging me and like literally holding my hand going out of the house. Mm-hmm. Went on medication and managed to get out of the house again and go for walks in the countryside, and it was really positive, actually. And if I hadn't done that then, I think I would be absolutely sure. Fucked.
Okay.
But anyway, I went on SSRIs called sertraline, which was recommended by the doctors to control the anxiety.
What was a milligram you're on? Because it's like they go from this like 150 to 100, 150, 50.
Well, yeah. So there's a different one called citalopram, all of them use different doses. So I was on 50 milligrams sertraline.
Cool. Okay.
Which is a standard first dose.
Yeah. Lots of my friends are on sertraline. It's quite common.
And it really did do the job, I think, because it brought it under control to the extent that. What happened before was I essentially went into a constant state of panic where there was no triggers and I was panicking because the panic attacks were just continually rolling. Yeah. And they weren't stopping and there was no trigger. I was at home in my safe space, even in my bedroom, I'd be having a panic attack about nothing, you know, it wasn't stopping because I couldn't have that breather to be like, this isn't real.
Yeah.
Just wasn't letting me do it. So that's what the meds did.
And can I just pause you?
Yeah,
because I love this. Because I
know it. I talk a lot.
It's just really fascinating. We've got time because you know when you just said with the sertraline and how you didn't have a break. Now I used to talk to people like this for years because I felt like I personally felt like I'd mastered panic disorder because as soon as my big fix, quote unquote, was realizing that. What a panic attack actually was and was doing to my body. And as soon as I knew what it was doing, the fear completely disappeared. I just never had a fear again, ever. But then last night, I panicked and I couldn't find a break in the panic. And that to me was mad.
Yeah.
But I wasn't necessarily panicking. Like, I wasn't like panicking how I was back in the day, like, oh my God, I'm going to die. But the panic was coming on and it was very difficult to kind of find a gap and trying to like, resolve it. But I mean, I guess I got through it because I did wake up and sleep and it was fine. But
panic attacks are like playing instruments.
Mm-hmm.
You master an instrument, then you don't play the instrument for 2 years, then you pick up the instrument and you don't know how to play it anymore.
That makes sense because I guess the feeling hasn't been, I haven't been used to that feeling.
You've forgotten how to control it. So,
but I'll tell you what, it was nice that I did control it though in the end. Yeah. It took me a while.
That's the thing. First time you ever pick up an instrument, you have no idea what to do. Once you've mastered an instrument and then drop it for 2 years, it takes a while to get back to it, but then you're back.
Yeah.
And you still have the skills.
Yeah.
It just takes longer.
I think that's really fascinating because there's like, I just really find it interesting when you said that about the break and the panic, because when I first went through it, I remember just, it was so, you can't find that break. It's like you're drowning.
Well, it's like you're not aware that there is a break.
No, we don't know there could be one.
Yeah.
Because you
don't even know what's going on.
You don't
know
it's mental. You think this is a physical attack. You think your body's like shutting down.
Yeah, yeah.
And the only way I can describe it is like drowning.
Yeah.
And like you can't get enough, you can't get above water. You can't reach the surface and you keep going. You get a little bit of it and come back down. Yeah. That's the break.
It's like a bad dream.
It's horrifying. Yeah. I'm so sorry to go off on one there. So yeah, you're on sertraline. No, it was really helpful because it helped you. Because I've never taken medication, which I think is still quite weird. A lot of people who have been for anxiety are like, have you not ever taken any medication? I took one beta blocker once. One.
Yeah.
I never took them again.
Yeah.
But I'd never felt the need. And sometimes I think maybe I should have done, but you know, I guess there's different ways to deal with stuff.
Yeah. Sertraline was perfect for me.
People do it and it tastes really good.
I took it in the wrong way, which is my fault because I didn't follow up with the doctor, which I should have done.
Okay.
So what I should have done is gone on sertraline for a few months and then come off it.
So that's it, because that's they say it's good to sort of to almost reformat.
Yeah.
And then seek counseling and therapy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
In that sort of process, but a lot of people did you stay on it for a long period?
I stayed on it for 2.5 years.
I know, I remember.
And that causes different problems. So it didn't make my anxiety get any worse. My anxiety ever since then was better than it had been in that extreme time where I couldn't leave the house. And I've never gone back to that stage. Yeah. And I don't think I ever will, because yeah. I'll never, ever let it get that bad.
And I don't think you can as well when you have been through it, that you kind of see through
it. Your body does know that.
That subconscious will always know.
Yeah.
Now you can't, as you're saying,
forged
before,
it again. A new connection that says, okay, because I still have a problem.
Yeah. But it's like riding a bike and the guitar analogy. It's like, it's not being funny, mate. You know, you know how to ride a bike now. Yeah. You don't have to
read. You know how to do the basics.
Yeah. If you get on it, you might not be an expert, but you know how to ride off straight away. It's one of those things.
Yeah. So, ever since then, I've been able to travel around Brighton. And actually, for the next two years after I went on sertraline, I was able to go back and forth between London. I didn't go anywhere else. Actually, no, I did. I went to my grandpa's in Horsham as well.
Okay.
Which is very rural, which a rurality, it's a bit of a tongue twister, is quite a big trigger for me.
Yeah.
Being out of town.
No hospital.
Yeah. It's not about that anymore, though. It's just about being away from my house.
Yeah.
Really.
It's kind of sad. It's like I can really see the development now.
Yeah. And it's detached completely from the original thing. So when I eventually get back down to it, I think I'll have to go right back to that to solve this problem.
Do you have how's it affect you now? How are things now? Because are you on medication still now?
Well, no, I was about to say that about 2 years ago.
So I saw you in a pub.
What?
And you were just, because I went for a drink with you and you were like, yeah, I've just come off it.
Oh yeah, that was a good feeling, man.
And you were in a great mindset.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, 2 years ago, I finished uni, and the finishing uni thing is a whole load of shit in itself, regardless of whether you have a mental illness.
That's another episode, mate. You finishing uni is like getting off a train, which you've been on for 10, 20 years, and suddenly realizing you're in a big wide world with nowhere to go.
Exactly.
Yeah, for real.
And I've not left Brighton for 2 years now. I've not left the city limits of Brighton for 2 years.
Yeah.
I've not been further, for people who live in Brighton, than the Marina, Hove Lagoon, Preston Park, and Brighton Uni on Lewis Road.
Is there a map in your head?
Yes, that's the problem.
You can see the lines.
Yes, that's one of my major problems that I go to the therapist and talk about.
Yeah.
Is I've drawn these very, very big lines on this map that I need to do.
You cross that line, what happens?
Well, at the moment, every day I'm crossing them.
Oh, I'm loving this. This is a really
But we'll get to there at the end, because I've got a very positive thing. So for the last 2 years, I have settled with those boundaries.
The comfort zone?
They've mainly remained the same.
So the comfort zone hasn't moved?
It hasn't moved.
Maybe it shrunk slightly or just going to stay the same?
I always thought, you know, it's better than being stuck at home. And actually this range is big enough for my quality of life to be normal. I essentially have a completely normal quality of life.
Yeah.
I can earn money. I can live. I can exercise. I can eat. And I can go to hospital. I can have relationships. I can have friendships.
Yeah.
I can see my mum and dad because they don't live very far away. Therefore, my body is essentially like, right. So when you're stuck at home, the way you get over it is, your subconscious is going, don't do anything. But your body goes, this is so ridiculous that I cannot let this happen.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is I got to an area where my quality... Because when you're at home, you do not have a life. You cannot have a quality of life. You can't go to the doctors. You can't go to the shops. You can't earn a living. Now that I can do all those things, my body goes, right, the way up isn't as good anymore. Therefore, the anxiety takes precedence and I will not push it. Anyway, I came off the medications in February last year. The medication gave me all sorts of side effects. I put on 6 stone.
That is a crazy amount of weight as well.
6 stone. I don't know if you've seen me when I was slim, but I was slimmer than
photos.
You are now.
I've seen photos.
When I had that first panic attack in Sussex on the Downs, the one I told you about, when I first went on thing, I was slimmer than you are now. And I went from 12.5 stone to 18 stone in 2 years.
Yeah, that's mad.
And so I went from being a normal weight to... in the top half, between 30 and 40 BMI, obese.
Okay, would you say that was definitely the sertraline?
It's a mixture of sertraline.
Because so many people I know who are on sertraline put on stones.
Everyone puts on weight on that drug. And it's funny, because if you go on citalopram, you lose loads of weight.
Yeah, I've seen that. Did you get shakes and stuff?
No. You have problems with sex.
Did you sweat a lot?
No.
Okay, because people get crazy side effects, man.
I had a lot of problem with sex. So I had a lot of problem with finishing.
Yeah.
I had a lot of problem with not anything to do with erectile dysfunction or anything like that.
But that could be a symptom, right? It could be a side effect.
Yeah. Lack of sex drive or lower sex drive.
I've heard that before. Massively.
What other things? Just a general like apathy towards the world, man. Just like, I don't give a fuck about anything.
The side effects.
I don't give a fuck about uni. I don't give a fuck about my... That's the thing. You don't give a shit about how you look.
Don't care, yeah.
And I didn't give a fuck about my health. I mean, everyone needs to realize at some point, like, health is important and stuff. Anyway, last Christmas 2018, I was 18 stone. And I hadn't seen my mum and dad and sister for a while. And I didn't really realize. I, in my head, probably thought I was 15 stone.
Yeah.
And my mum and dad and sister came and they were visibly shocked.
Really?
And they were like, you have to do something about this and you will get diabetes and you will die eventually, or you'll have to have... And I never, ever considered the fact that my weight would cause me any sort of physical illness. And this is nothing to do with health anxiety. I just went, I don't want to be known as someone who has diabetes because I've not looked after myself.
Oh, it's a horrible feeling as well, man.
And once I realized that, I just changed my lifestyle and I've been, my sister's a dietitian, not a dietitian, a nutritionist. And so I've always listened to her advice, and her advice is, now this is a bit controversial because I know you lose weight in a different way to I do.
Yeah.
And a lot of people do.
Well, go on.
But she, for me personally, she this, she would give everyone different plans, but she's always told me to lose weight slowly.
Yeah.
So I've been doing it slowly. I've never done keto or anything like that.
But why is that different to me?
Oh, I thought that you did keto. Maybe it's not you. Some,
well, no,
someone else I know does.
I was 15 stone as a kid.
Yeah.
I'm like 12 and a half, 13 now. Yeah. And I was 15 stone as a kid. And how I lost weight wasn't really exercise. I just stopped eating shit.
Yeah.
And I stopped drinking fizzy drinks. So I lost it that way. I just did the slow burn.
I'm confusing you with someone else.
That's right. But my weight loss was like a slow burner. It was like I would just not drink fizzy drinks. I wouldn't eat loads of chocolate. I would just have breakfast.
You lose lunch, it over time.
And fruit. And I lost loads of good weight.
Nice. My sister told me, because she knows my personality, that if I did keto, I would lose the weight and then put it back on.
Yeah, you have to do it. I think it's. And do you know what, Matt? I'm looking at you now and I'm so proud of you.
Well, that's
you
the thing really is that
good.
I.
Like, you look healthy.
I'm taking the time, and it's taking a long time. But the nice thing for me is that I'm never putting on weight again.
You look fantastic, mate.
I keep losing it.
When you walked in that door, I was like, bro. Marry me.
Well, the thing that's ironic is I'm only halfway.
You're looking great for halfway, mate.
Well,
done bits.
Well,
how tall are you? 5'9", 5'10"?
5'10". 5'10". So I'm still in the unhealthy category, unfortunately.
How much are you weighing now, if you don't mind? Don't have to say.
Well, I don't know.
Oh, okay.
So
we'll find out. Yeah.
At the beginning of lockdown, I was 16 stone.
Okay, that's still really good compared to 18, mate.
Well, yeah, I'd lost two stone. But you're still, I'm still overweight and actually obese at that stage, according to BMI. I don't know if BMI is real.
There's questions, but
it's not a healthy weight.
Yeah.
Everyone says I've lost down weight since then. I mean, the last time you saw me was lockdown, so if I've lost weight since then, so I must be below 16.
Yeah, definitely. You're definitely around, below 16 stone, mate.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So I'm around that, maybe in the 15s, somewhere
maybe
like
that. Maybe in the
14s. Well, I don't quite think so. But anyway, we can finally get on to this final part of my life.
Go on.
So the anxiety has been completely at bay since I went on sertraline 3 years ago.
Sorry, yes.
I came off the sertraline last year because of the weight issue. The fact that it wasn't solving my agoraphobia.
It was just keeping me in that bubble. It was just that comfort zone.
It's just a plaster on the cut that keeps reopening.
Love that. Can I just pause you before we get to the last one? I know I'm going to keep doing this, but it's just I forget all these points. One, the weight thing. I've got friends who struggle with their weight and they keep avoiding it. I've got a friend who is not very happy with his weight and has always been overweight, according to him.
Yeah.
And he's very sad. And I know it affects him a lot. And I just wish that he would take that step. And I know it's so difficult for him to take that step. And would you say that step was extremely difficult? Or was it like, as soon as you know what you want to do, you just do it? Was it like a quick thing?
That's no, a very interview style quick. Question, it's, but I just wanted to ask you that.
That is the reason it's so difficult for people to lose weight. And the thing, there's several factors, I think, because I think people don't know this. Again, it's similar to cocaine, that you're actually more likely to have a mental illness because of obesity. Mm. This has only come out in the last few years, that actually being obese can cause a completely normally mental person to become mentally ill.
That's so fascinating.
Because of, it's a completely scientific thing.
Sure.
And actually being overweight, like a lot of people think being overweight causes depression because you're unhappy about yourself, but actually physically causes depression. That's through so your like brain
there's stuff going
chemicals
on. That's just mad.
And it's because there's a lot more research into what causes depression now.
Yeah,
and it's all about your gut.
Yeah, okay.
That's so anyone out there who has depression, obviously there's never any cure, right? But I drink a small bottle of kefir every day.
Oh, okay.
So kefir is like fermented yogurt, basically. Yeah. It's like a Yakult, but a natural one. And my mood and general feeling, just from that change alone, because if you ate McDonald's all day and had a kefir, you'd feel like shit and you'd still put on loads of weight. But stuff like that can really help because your mental mood, your mental health, your strength is very, very heavily linked. And this is not like some Joe Rogan shit, man. No. Like this is real stuff.
Yeah.
Is incredibly highly linked with what you're eating.
Yeah.
And kefir is just a really good, healthy thing to have. Drinking yogurt.
That's really fascinating because that was actually going to my second point before we move on to this last part of your journey, because you mentioned the medication is like a plaster on the wound. You know when people are trying to lose weight, right? I'm going to reference mental health now. For me, people that lose weight and people that take medication, so people that exclusively just exercise and exclusively take medication for mental health and exercise to lose weight, right? Two different categories here. Exercising without but eating shit still is the same as, I think, people that take medication but don't actually address those problems as well by talking about it.
Yeah.
You are literally just putting a plaster on the wound.
Yeah.
Like exercising for trying to lose weight, you're just putting a plaster on the actual situation, which is you need to change your diet as well. Yeah, that's like the most important
actually,
thing.
Actually, there's quite a lot of evidence that if you could exercise fucking all day, every day, if you don't eat shit, if you eat shit, you will not lose weight.
Same for medication, I think. What you were saying there, medication's like the plaster on the wound. You're not actually dealing with the problem. My mum earlier, right, was like talking about one of her friends and she was like, oh, she's really suffering. You know, she's gone to the doctors. They're giving her this, they're giving her that. And I'm like, has she had any counselling or therapy? And she was like, well, no, but she's gone to the doctors. Look, I know medication is an easy thing to go and secure. And definitely if you are in that constant state of dread and panic, you need to restabilize. But the importance of understanding why these triggers come in the first place, actually knowing yourself and having that chat with yourself and someone else is the most important thing. And medication, all that's going to do is make it harder when you fuck. Because all my friends who are on medication, when they came off without therapy and counselling, when they came off medication, fuck me. Give it 6 months and like, oh, I'm great, I feel great. Panic attack. Oh my God, I've got a problem, so I've got to go back on medication.
Yeah.
That's not the problem here because you've just put a temporary plaster on the wound.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I just had to cover those two points.
No, it's fine. But that brings me really on to...
Good.
So, for the last 2 years, I've been able to keep it at bay. I've had no major incidents. That's because I haven't been going out of my comfort zone.
Yeah. So it's been, like, easy to live?
Yeah.
In March, that sense.
End of March, two of my best friends come down. Coronavirus is nothing but a distant dream at this point. Just a little thing in the news. You're hearing about lockdowns in other countries.
End of Feb, though, right?
No. End of March.
Okay.
Middle of March.
Because we were in lockdown middle of March, weren't we?
No, we started lockdown 24th. Everything happened in 1 week.
Yeah.
Okay. So the weekend before everything started to feel serious, two of my best friends came down and we drank an enormous amount of alcohol. Yeah. Like far more than I usually do. Ate an enormous amount of shit as well. And did that for two nights in a row. And they went home on Sunday. And I was sat at home. This is the Sunday before lockdown. And the news feed still, mate, no one was taking it seriously still at that point.
People are out about anything.
Everything was open. The only thing that had stopped was like My New Lane, I remember, cancelled the night before at the Arch. And Ski Mask cancelled at Patton's. That was the only, they just cancelled. And it clearly wasn't because of coronavirus, because at that point, coronavirus clearly wasn't a thing. I'm being sarcastic here. But, and then on the Sunday, I was at home on my own. I'd work the next morning, so I was like, oh, I've got to get an early night. Playing Battlefield 5, which is a shit game.
I know.
And
I
it's incredibly stressful and PTSD-inducing. Anyway, so I'd had 2 days on the trot drinking, 2 weekends in a row drinking a lot, loads of shit, not enough sleep. News feed is full of crap about coronavirus and also about an asteroid that was going to hit Earth.
Oh, yeah. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Me, I couldn't sleep at night because of that.
Yeah, I'm glad you were the same. And I was playing Battlefield and I was reading this article. And the one about the asteroid was actually what set it off.
Yeah, I had
It was everything. And I was just sitting on my sofa and I got the biggest adrenaline surge I've had in my life. Wow, it was the most severe. I literally felt like I'd taken off in a rocket. Like I was like that. And I literally bolted up. And I this happens to me fairly regularly, like panicky moments for about a second. And I always just settle it back down. And I just knew this one wasn't going quickly. Mm-hmm. So I ran into my room, closed my curtains, because that always helps, because it's quite bright. And I just sat down, started meditating.
Okay.
Because I've meditated for years. Good. And it always controls it.
That's great.
And I was sitting there, and I was meditating, and it was just growing.
Can't do it.
And I was like, fuck me. What the fuck is going on here? Like, this is, something's not right. And for the first time in a very, very long time, I was like, right, I need to solve this right now. I'm going to take some Valium, which I never do.
Okay.
Because Valium is incredibly addictive and will kill you. If you take it for literally more than 2 days, you'll get addicted to it. And then you can die quite easily from it, overdosing and that. And turns into a zombie. And, you know, it's an awful drug. Lil Peep, same thing. Same thing, but...
Yeah, okay.
All these guys dying, a lot of them are from...
I never take Valium myself, but...
Yeah, there's a reason it's addictive. All your problems, all your anxieties, gone.
Yeah.
Completely, you're back to being a baby. That's why it's so addictive. So anyway, took two. And just kept meditating. Had to... But, do you know what's a great thing for panic attack? Just watching porn.
Wow, really?
Not doing anything else.
That's mad.
Just watching it. Because it's so, sex is such an instinctual drive for us.
Oh, that's very, very mad.
That it just, it like bypasses stuff and you are concentrating on that.
Is that why when I get anxious, it's I want to have sex with someone?
It might be.
Wow.
Although I feel like that probably isn't.
No, but
I think that's something different.
Could that be? Not that just, might be sorry, what makes not you... even just me, but like, is that why a lot of people are drawn to sex when they're worried and they're anxious?
Probably.
It's like a way of dealing with their problems. Yeah,
probably. If you see, you know, sex on screen, you know what? Like being a human is like, sex takes over your brain, especially when you're horny. So,
well, it's an animal instinct, isn't it? Really?
I've used that technique before on a train platform. So I'd sort of cover my screen. But yeah, and it's not for any sexual pleasure. It just distracts you.
That's enough, so fascinating.
It gives you enough time to get that break.
Yeah,
and to
No, I'm okay. So with you.
Yeah, yeah. So I did the meditation. I watched a bit of porn and I took a Valium. And then the Valium kicked in about 10, 15 minutes later. And then I was like...
Oh, it's quite quick then.
Yeah, it's just a quick. It's not, doesn't take too long. And I was like, oh, God.
Yeah.
Thank God for that. It's all good. And I was like, okay, I've taken that now. And whenever I take Valium, it goes. Mm-hmm. So I was like, right, I just better go to bed then. Because it was quite late. I had a shift at 6 in the morning. Ooh. So I went to bed early. I went to bed at like 7 in the evening. Great night's sleep. Woke up, went to work, and I was like, oh, thank God that's over. I must have just... And I was like, at that point, because quite often when I drink, for a couple of days after, I get pangs like that. So I just thought that was a particularly bad pang because I've drunk so much.
Yeah.
Nothing out of the ordinary. I mean, it's slightly out of the ordinary, but it's nothing I can't handle. And I go to work the next day at 6 in the morning. The only thing people are talking about is coronavirus. This is when the hysteria starts to kick in. And it's just not really good feeling to have.
And well, it was I went through the same thing. Yeah, it really, yeah. really did stress me out.
And I just did my work. I went home. I still felt fine. And I was like, okay, this whole coronavirus thing is scary, but it's like, it's not real. Mm. Clearly, coronavirus is not going to do what it's done in Italy.
Yeah.
And I actually was thinking things like, British people are far better. They're much more cleaner than Italians.
People have those thoughts.
Yeah, big time, mate. That's why it's hit us so hard. Because we went, Italians and Spanish, they're so blasé about everything. They love kissing and hugging each other. We don't do that. We're British and stiff upper lip.
2 weeks later.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, no. I'm not went home. That, but yeah.
Spoke to one of my good friends, Akshay, bless him. It's not his fault.
Yeah.
First thing he says, oh my God, have you heard about those people dying in Italy? And the exact same thing happened again.
Wow, I got staring in.
So I've never had that before. I've never had two panic attacks on 2 days. And I was still under the influence of Valium.
Oh, so then you're like, I can't actually deal with
this. So then I went, Valium's not even working. And then I had to spend the entire day. So I took Valium again, which I've never done. And I spent the entire day literally... I know, so when Akshay did that thing, I went... sat down, did the meditation. Meditation wasn't working. So I literally got dressed, went to the gym and did a workout. Wow. Gym was empty, which again was feeding into my like, why is no one here?
Worry, mate. This is a trigger.
Why is no one here? And this was really starting to be like, okay, maybe this coronavirus is a real thing. And then, but the workout worked as it always does. It gets rid of that energy. And I really pushed it out. Yeah, and nice. I felt
well
great,
done.
Mate.
Well done, yeah.
And I went home. And it just happened.
Of course it did.
Again.
Can't escape.
And it just came back. My girlfriend came home from work and I just burst into tears.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
And I knew from that point that I could not again take Valium.
So you had
because
no
I would be
lifeline.
Addicted to it. I had no lifeline. And it just dawned on me this was going to be a difficult few days. And knowing my, of all the people, right, of the having luck, the next day I woke up and actually, because I was with my girlfriend, I was much more able to distract myself. And so I had not had a panic attack, knock on wood, since that day. And that was 5 months ago.
Okay.
And since that day, I have not drunk a drop of alcohol and I've not smoked a cigarette or not had a can of Coke because Diet Amazing. Coke really is bad for anxiety.
Yeah, okay.
It's got lots of caffeine in it. And I managed to get over it then, get over the initial like impact and I haven't panicked on that level since. Knowing my luck, I developed fever-like symptoms the next day.
Mate,
been working in retail.
You're a key worker, so...
Yeah, and I had a huge swelling on the side of my face. Oh, and I was like, well, clearly I've got coronavirus.
Clearly I'm going to die now.
Yeah, clearly. And at this
it's
point,
just been building
they
up to,
didn't like... know that it, you know, really only, let's be honest, it really only affects a certain type of people, either elderly people or people with underlying conditions. We weren't as sure at that point that most people are already just get it, it's flu, and it goes. Yeah. And actually, apparently, most of us get it and we don't even know we've got it.
Yeah.
So I went... fuck me, I've got coronavirus. But at the same time, I was like, I can't not go to work because I cannot sit at home.
Mentally.
So the way I was dealing with it was by working all day, every day.
Yeah.
So the first 2 weeks, I worked 14 days in a row.
Just to distract yourself.
Just to get through it. And I'm glad I did it because got me through it. But turns out I just had swelling on my tooth.
Oh, interesting.
And which did all sorts of weird things to me.
Oh, okay.
But for about 4 days, I thought I had coronavirus, which was absolutely terrifying because at that point I was seeing videos on Twitter and stuff of people my age dying. Anyway, that was the point where I deleted all my social media.
Yeah, smart.
I bought a puzzle book with Sudoku in it, downloaded a load of crosswords on my phone and got into a really good habit of a really strong routine and I've kept it since. And anyway, the initial phase was about 2-3 weeks. Even a week after the initial panic attack, I was seriously contemplating suicide. Like seriously thinking about it. I've never got to the point where I actually think about doing it. Like I never actually am like, right, this is how I do it. I'm just like, I can't solve this problem. Surely suicide will solve this problem. Like dying would probably be easier. It's the ultimate avoidance strategy.
Yeah.
And this is avoidance.
A lot of people say that suicide can't be, well, people have this idea of suicide and don't take people seriously unless they're like contemplating how they're going to do it. But I think, as we all know now and people should know, suicide can be as simple as saying to yourself, I don't want to live anymore.
Yeah.
Or as simple as being like, do you know, wouldn't it be better if how would it be if I died tomorrow? Yeah. And you start fantasizing. Yeah. You go in that fantasy world.
And actually, I think I didn't even get that far.
Okay. And that's that should never be.
Yeah. Well, it's comforting to me personally because I didn't get that far.
Yeah, but it should be comforting to everyone.
Because I think I'm very lucky, because if this had happened without prior experience, so I probably would have done something stupid.
Right.
But I did, there was a part of me that knew that, like, you're in it for the long run, but this won't last forever.
Yeah.
But there were a few points where I was like, this feels like it's not going to go away. Because every panic attack I've had up to this point in my life has lasted 2 or 3 days. I am actually 5 months on, still not back to normal now.
Yeah.
And I'm still having slight issues.
You're kind of numb to it.
Yeah. Well, the fact that I haven't drunk and haven't smoked and haven't done any Diet Coke and I've been exercising twice the amount, eating half as much and working twice as much and having more money means that my mental state is the best it's been in 4 or 5 years. And actually now, so I bought a bike about 2 months ago, halfway through the lockdown. And I have been cycling and I've been crossing my previous lines every day and going further every day.
Yeah, massive.
So that I am now expanding it, like every day I go on the bike.
That's crazy.
Swimming in the sea, something I didn't used to do.
Yeah.
Going up to way past Preston Park, going to Hove Lagoon. I've seen Hove Lagoon for the first time in my life.
How's that feel?
The ironic thing is, it's really encouraging about this, is I'm not actually even going to the full extent of my boundaries. I'm testing the water.
Yeah, that's smart.
I'm pushing it.
I'm just taking it slow, mate.
I'm not going to the point of having a panic attack.
Yeah.
So I don't want that to happen because I think that's counterproductive. But it feels great. And it's really for the first time in years where I've gone, maybe this isn't actually impossible.
Mm.
And actually, do you know Madeira Drive?
Yeah.
You know, at the bottom, like when you get to the end, there's like a little ramp and you go and as the car park.
Yeah, into the marina.
For 2 years, I've gone up to that ramp and I've never gone over it. Wow. I've never known what's on the other side. And I thought it was just be more like path. Finally went over it 2 weeks ago and it's like beautiful cliffs and shit. Right. And that is when you start to go, not only is this good for me, but I enjoy being here.
Yeah,
for the first time, I'm enjoying it. And I'm going,
love that.
Oh, and bro, do you know what my lockdown project has been? Playing the guitar, right? So I've always been a sort of amateur guitarist. Yeah. And I've like, not blown my own trumpet, but I've improved so much that I am now like, I'm an actual guitarist. And I've got this great feeling of satisfaction that I could probably now play in public.
Nice.
If I wanted to. And another thing I've realized about it is it is my number one anti-anxiety medication.
Mad.
Is sitting down and playing an instrument.
I love that.
And I have not touched diazepam. I will never go on antidepressants again. At the beginning of the pandemic, I rang the doctor and said, I need to go on antidepressants. She gave them to me. I got them.
Didn't take them.
She
left them in a drawer.
Yeah, I don't even know where they are.
Yeah.
Somewhere in my room.
We're coming towards the end and I want to make sure that we're getting a lot of these important things covered. But would you say...
I've been talking so much. You need to structure it a bit more for me.
Relax.
Okay, fine.
Everything's fine, mate. That's the whole point.
Don't want to mess up your podcast.
You're not messing up the podcast, mate. The thing is, like, I just want to hear this side of the story. We don't ever talk about this. And also, I haven't really heard it from you in a while. And I'd spent the last episode talking about my life.
So. Also, I've made it a whole way through without being upset.
Yeah, it's really good. It's really massive achievement.
Or having to run out of the room.
Yeah, mate, it's huge. And there's one thing I'll say, like, I think the whole point of this is there's this feeling of dread that's constantly there. And we don't ever realise that there is just a few extra steps that need to be done in order to, like, quarantine show, like, not just quarantine, but what happened in the last 5 months has taught you more than you've ever known about yourself.
Yeah.
And that's for a lot of people, but quarantine or not, and put that to one side, a lot of us are so trapped in this comfort zone because we think it's a good thing for us. The moral of this entire chat for both of us is this comfort zone idea, because that can revolve around how close you to us will. That can revolve around I meditate when I feel anxious. That can revolve around me last night having to put friends on because I couldn't calm down my breathing and I was like panicking for no reason. Or maybe there was a reason. But everything is about the comfort zone.
Yeah.
And it's funny because the strongest points in my life where I've really felt fan-fucking-tastic is when I've always taken a step, even if it's just one step over that line, you mentally or physically. Yeah.
It's so easy, I think, in the modern world to feel like you have no control over your life.
Yeah.
And actually, even if your life's
and that's what eats away at you, mate.
Yeah. And from that Monday morning, which was, you know, however many weeks ago,
four and a half,
I have not taken any medication.
That's great.
And I have had the most extreme mental punishment I've ever experienced.
Turbulence, right?
And I have a fucking great feeling because I have got through it through sheer determination, like sheer, you can't beat me.
Yeah.
And I've come out the other side.
Mate, it's so
and I'm
true.
Like, I've mate, fucking beaten
up.
You.
Mate, lap it up.
And like, I haven't.
Feels fucking good.
It's ironic because I still have agoraphobia. I still can't go to lots of places, but for the first time in years,
finally tackling
I've really.
Shit,
I've really put it like almost on the back foot, if that makes sense.
Yeah, mate, you have.
And really made it go like, no matter. And I still, as I said, I still haven't fully recovered from that initial, that panic attack was so bad.
Yeah.
I'm still scared of it 4.5 months later.
Understandably though.
I'm
scared of the panic attack I had last night. I'm going to go drink tonight. I'm going to smoke tonight. Yeah. My friend's having people around in the garden. I'm like, when I get into bed, I'm going to have that. I'm dreading that bed thing. I need to change that. How am I going to change it? So I know that feeling straight up.
And this always happens when people give up things, isn't it? But, mate, my life without cigarettes and alcohol is just 10 times better.
Yeah, I can imagine. Because we use it as a...
Oh, like, I have just stopped relying on it.
Yeah.
Cigarettes is different because they don't really...
But alcohol.
Alcohol is the main one.
Yeah.
Cigarettes are just... They're nice in a different way.
Yeah.
But I didn't realise that cigarettes do cause anxiety. I didn't realize it's kind of similar to caffeine in that they release stress hormones.
The only thing they do differently, because I used to say to my therapist, like, smoking calms me down. And she was like, it's only because of how you're breathing. That's the only one positive thing you're doing when you're smoking, because you're breathing slow. It's almost like a form of meditative breathing. But obviously, you're breathing in the worst kind of stuff. Yeah. But there's like a little correlation there.
And you know that, how much do you smoke a day? Be honest.
Probably like. If I'm going like yesterday
on an average day, not a drinking day.
Okay, because yesterday I must have smoked about like 15, 20.
So that's quite a lot.
I was out all day. Yeah, but on an average day, like 5.
That's not your normal day. Yeah,
average day about that. Under 10. Yeah. Under 10 easily.
So you're not a serious addict, but you have a.
I'm not smoking 20 to 40 a day. No. Yeah,
but you can't just now not smoke for a week if you didn't put any effort in.
I'll be honest.
You would probably like, oh, I want a cigarette.
I've stopped smoking and drinking in my past.
Yeah.
But that's because it felt like my anxiety was controlling me to not smoke and drink.
Okay.
And I felt like I was doing it to serve the almighty anxiety panic attack that was looming over me.
Yeah.
Whereas I started smoking again almost in defiance to the anxiety, which is the stupidest thing to say out loud.
Yeah.
But it's almost like...
I know what you mean.
Fuck you.
Part of my lack of alcohol still drinking is serving the almighty god of alcohol. But I've also
found that
slowly,
you like it.
I actually really enjoy
actually,
not drinking.
I really like this, so yeah, see you later.
So it's almost lost that now. And actually, I've now got to the point where I could, because the main reason I didn't drink was that it will cause me to have another panic attack. I don't think that will happen now, but I feel so clear.
Yeah.
Anyway, what I was going to say is, you know, every time you have a cigarette, about an hour later, your body's releasing cortisol,
right,
which is a stress hormone.
Fair, mad. That's madness.
So it's causing you anxiety.
To have another cigarette.
If you go, you don't drink coffee, do you?
I do.
It's another one.
I had a coffee just now.
Yeah.
But the thing
if you can handle it, you can handle it. But you, if you cut them out.
Basically, I want to get this, I really want to talk about this point because we're running out of time, right? And I really want to like just say this one thing because I love this conversation we're having now is so important to me because I've wanted to talk about this for ages. You were just talking about you and your relationship with the anxiety and how it's still kind of looming over you, but you're still taking one step at a time, right? And the anxiety goes from this really scary demon cloud that's constantly above your head. It's almost like you're sitting on the beach and there's this constant storm above you all the time. And it's not a peaceful storm. It's like a dangerous, deadly storm. And then the more we kind of take control of the anxiety, that storm becomes... It kind of fades from a really dark storm to like actually suddenly it's a really sunny day. You're on the beach. It's really hot. You can hear planes going. You can hear like lawnmowers in the distance, and you see one little wispy white cloud miles away, and it's probably a little rain cloud, but it's so far away it would never affect your life. And
that's
you can just
thing.
See it drift past.
It's
right?
there, and you're aware of it, but it's not in your face.
Yeah,
see, and it's not it's raining on
yeah,
you.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
just.
But see. My thing is that, do you know what, right? So when I first had my big panic attack back in the day.
It's the name of the podcast.
I stopped smoking, I stopped drinking, I stopped like going out and I restricted my comfort zone. You can always imagine me sitting on the floor with my hands over my knees, rocking. That was kind of my sort of physical symptoms. I was like, do you know what? I'm going to just stay in my room. It can't get me in here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like it's Very some easy. Sort of monster, mate. Yeah. Like, but anyway, so... For years and years, I stopped doing certain things that I really enjoyed and that I liked because of the anxiety. But it wasn't until I started to master the panic disorder and actually understand that I wasn't fearful of the panic attacks because I knew what they were. I broke down the scientific nature to them. So caffeine, I started to enjoy again. Because when I had the heart racing after having a coffee, I was like, well, it's just because I had a coffee. Like, it's not that deep.
That's what I mean. If you can control that, it's completely
fine,
isn't it?
But then last night, I've been drinking all day, I've been smoking, I didn't have that much good food, and I started panicking at night. I was like, I'm not getting enough oxygen to my lungs. Maybe it's the smoking, maybe it's drinking. And I started to freak out. And it's interesting, because I know for a fact that the real reason was because I needed to sleep, I was bloated from drinking alcohol all day. Like, I had beers all day, just beers.
Yeah.
I felt bloated. I had a pizza for dinner. I didn't feel good. I was just in bed, and my body didn't feel good. And that kind of gave me alarm bells, because it had been so long since I'd felt that really horrible, unhealthy sensation, because I've done so well for my body in the last however long. Yeah, I've been smoking and drinking, but honestly, like, the exercise I do, the food I eat, the diet I have, the workouts I do every day, and that's like you not drinking and smoking now. Your body's a temple, mate, and when you respect it, you don't really have... You can't encourage that anxiety.
Yeah.
And it almost... It goes from this big cloud to like a little like ant on the floor where you're like, you don't even bother me anymore. I know that feeling, and I think that entity gets smaller and smaller and smaller.
That's what I mean, man.
And you're on the right path. You're like doing bits.
Like lockdown, food in terms of cooking was never anything I was particularly interested in.
And now you're doing it like every day, right? You're like doing bits.
Well, I was going to say, like, I never bothered really that much with cooking different stuff.
Always the same comfort.
Like,
comfort zone.
For a year and a half, I've eaten much better.
Yeah.
But it's been quite a lot of the same stuff.
Yeah.
Like just like soups and stuff. Yeah. Ramen and stir fries. Yeah. Lots of greens, you know, low carbs and everything. Good. But the nice thing about lockdowns is it's given me loads of extra time to try some different cooking, and it just helps and helps and helps. And I've eaten a lot better since lockdown, and it's just easy to control, isn't it?
Yeah.
People might be listening and might be wondering why I talk about food so much, and it's not to do with my weight issues, it's to do with the fact that this is the future of mental health.
Yeah, entirely.
Food and exercise.
We
that
don't
is
realize.
The future of mental health treatment.
Yeah.
They will not be giving you pills in 50 years.
It's an interesting thought.
They'll be giving you, telling you
advice.
Broccoli.
Yeah.
You know, spinach. The greens.
There's this mad thing because there's that relationship between food, medication, and like physical exercise, but also we can't forget the mental exercises in terms of talking
and
breaking it down. So many of us just go one or the other.
Yeah.
And they think, oh, we'll do this.
Yeah. I have to accept, after this conversation, I will probably feel a bit shit, actually.
Yeah, it's a shame.
No, but it's part of it. Because that's the reason why people don't talk about it.
Yeah.
Because I've brought a lot of quite uncomfortable stuff up. Mm. The thing about me when I talk about this, I sort of sometimes give people the impression that it doesn't faze me. But if you listen back to their podcast, you can hear me going like this the whole time because I'm nervous.
Yeah, it's scary though.
And it's, you can feel it's a real big,
yeah,
it's like a horrible thing inside me.
Do you not feel like different for talking about it though?
I feel less tense.
Yeah.
I feel less tense. But I will probably, for the rest of the day, feel a bit...
Yeah.
But then tomorrow be feel
have
better.
You got any plans today though?
Yeah, well, one of my good friends is coming down to visit.
Mate, that sounds
like swimming in the sea all day.
Man, that's sick.
And then got to make a massive nice dinner later. So exactly, I'm filling my day with positive activities.
Fine, have a great
not
day.
Drinking any alcohol no. again.
Have a great day.
And this is the thing, right, about alcohol and my relationship with it, is that I have had to accept that I really, I've given up cigarettes because cigarettes have absolutely no benefit to me.
Yeah.
Alcohol does benefit people in ways, especially for like special occasions, like if you, you know, have birthdays, weddings, it's nice to have a drink, you know what I mean? And it can help with socialization. Like, imagine going on a date without having a drink. I wouldn't go on a date without having at least a drink.
It's scary, bro. Yeah. I've done it before.
But that is, I think that's a completely normal human thing. That's nothing to do with social anxiety or anything. It's just like, I'd like a drink to take the edge off. But the thing with me, I've had to accept, and the beautiful thing about this time is this: if this coronavirus hadn't happened, none of us would have done this shit, man. Unless we'd had some epiphany in another way.
That's what I'm saying, man. It makes you step back.
Yeah.
I don't want to focus on the coronavirus too much, but we had to in terms of kind of going through your recent steps. Yeah. But definitely for me, mate.
Well, what I was going to say
this podcast
is that there's been no social activities until recently. Therefore, I've had no excuse to drink. Mm. Girlfriend doesn't really drink.
Yeah.
Housemate doesn't really drink.
Would you struggle when things start to pick up again? That's the question, right?
Well, but the thing is,
that bridge we come to, right?
Things have picked up.
Yeah.
And the pubs have been open for almost...
Have you been to
two
a
pub? 3 weeks? No. Not interested in it.
Okay.
I don't... The thing is, right, this is going to sound weird, even to you, maybe. I don't like going to a pub.
Yeah.
I don't like clubbing. I don't really like going out.
Yeah, fair enough.
And that's nothing to do with any sort of issue.
No.
I just don't enjoy it.
Fair enough, there you go.
And actually, I like sitting in parks.
Yeah, nice.
And I like doing weird things like walking into graveyards at 3 a.m.
But that's fine.
That's what makes me feel alive.
Fair enough.
But yeah, I've had to accept through coronavirus that alcohol is something that I need to treat with more respect.
Okay.
And drink it in a different way.
But the thing
is, I drink it like water.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And actually, as I said, like, there's an element of bowing down to the big anxiety god in the sky, but alcohol is not something that I can drink like water.
No.
If I want to live the life I want to live,
yeah,
I have to accept that my anxiety will not improve without it. And that is not bowing down to the god. No. That's saying, you know, the more I drink, the harder it is. And the fact that I haven't drunk or smoked has made it, I wouldn't be able to make the progress I've been making without that.
Yeah. There's this thing, because we're going to have to finish up in a second because we're literally on the...
Sorry,
we're on the brink, mate. Yeah. We're on the brink now on this podcast. But no, for real.
It's so ingrained in our society, man.
But alcohol is like... I was actually chatting to someone a couple of years ago who stopped drinking, and he was like, honestly, ask yourself this question. When you say you have a healthy... people can have a healthy relationship with alcohol, think about how fucking stupid that sounds.
Yeah.
How the fuck can you have a healthy relationship with alcohol? Like, none of us do. I told my mum the other day, and I was like, you know, alcohol's a drug. And, you know, my parents are like, drug? No, it's not. A drug's like heroin.
Yeah.
No, listen, having a healthy relationship with alcohol is so, you're just kidding yourself, really.
Yeah.
Like, we're all like, if you're drinking alcohol, like, there's a bit of a thing going on. Yeah. But I guess I like alcohol, and
I fucking love alcohol.
I like smoking, and it's terrible for you. It's so bad for you. I'm going to probably stop smoking soon. I can feel it coming. I'm getting to that point now where I'm smoking less and less. I'm like,
what's the brilliant thing? Is that it's so much easier to give up when you're like you. I only smoked 2 or 3 a day.
Yeah.
So giving up was easy.
Yeah. I'm quite at peace myself without smoking.
Yeah.
But alcohol wise, I like going for pints. But again, it's a social thing. I could probably go out and just drink soft drinks, but I like having a few beers here and there. I like the danger of life like that.
Yeah.
Sounds deep as fuck, but that's kind of how it is.
No, I know what you mean.
But I've got that relationship with it where I kind of control it. I know yesterday I felt anxious because I had a big day drink, and that's fine, and that's just okay. And also I was worried about this podcast.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, you know, this was the first episode and I just wanted to kind of, you know, there was no structure here.
Yeah.
I think it's been interesting. I think it's been good to kind of talk to you and just kind of see what you're going on, how things are going. And I think, like, a lot of people, we've had quite an in-depth conversation today. Fuck me.
I think it's important.
There's a lot of layers.
Yeah, like, I always sound like, oh, I don't know how to describe it, but I don't want to sound like, oh, I'm so aware of myself.
Yeah.
But I do genuinely feel like when I talk to other people about similar experience, it does seem to me that I seem to be more aware of myself.
Yeah.
And that I, like, think it's a good idea for me to come on a show like this and say, like, let's not dance around this shit. Mm. Like, it's real. Yeah. It's dangerous. Yeah. It's scary. But we live in a world where mental health is becoming this weird thing,
yeah,
where it's difficult to difficult to say it without sounding like a dick, but like a lot of people who maybe don't have mental illnesses have developed them because of the exposure with what it's got. And I think part of my mental health issues have come from the fact that when I was a teenager, I really wanted to have one.
Wow, really? Yeah. Mad.
Because as a stupid teenager, what is the way to get sympathy?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a physical illness.
No, I feel what you're
saying. I have some inkling of a mental one. So I accelerate it. I elevate it to this level. And I think that that's a serious problem for a lot of people. And unfortunately, that is something that if you say, a lot of people get very upset about that. Mm. Because they think, that's not real. It is real. I don't give a shit because I've done it myself.
Yeah, and the honesty needs to be there as well.
Yeah, it does.
This conversation like is important because as well, so many people just, this to some people is quite a depressing conversation.
But actually, to me, it's very positive.
Yeah, mate, this conversation
And I can tell you're feeling positive as well.
It's great, mate. I'm like ready for the day. But do
you know why?
Why?
It's because we're veterans.
Maybe so.
I think it's because we've been dealing with for a long
same time. Same age. We both, our story is almost different circumstances, a lot of, very similar timeline.
A lot of my friends who have maybe issues now have developed them a lot more recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same with my
Whereas
friends.
We've been struggling for years. And therefore, we're a bit more like...
Yeah. I can definitely control used it to more. It. I can definitely control it more. Yeah. But last night was a bit of a shock. I didn't like it. And I've had a bit of lack of sleep. And now I'm like, I've got this thing tonight. Am I going to feel tired? I'm quite tired today. What's going to happen? But again, some people listening to this are going to be like, wow, that was a really fucking morbid chat.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, it's not morbid because me and you are like making steps. So like every year for us, because we keep learning new things every year, mate, by the time we hit 30, really, this would be so far behind us. There'll always be elements of stuff there because life changes all the time. There'll be new worries and new fears, but it will naturally get less and less prominent the more we challenge that comfort zone, the more we challenge ourselves. So actually, this is positive because, mate, even though I feel like, okay, I feel a bit anxious today because of that sleep last night. That's on my mind.
Mm.
But I'll be honest with you, mate. If you compare it to 10 years ago, fuck me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
There was no control.
I didn't know what to do with myself. Yeah, this anxiety was like, I would like cry and beg it to leave me alone.
Yeah.
I was a 16, 17-year-old boy crying.
Think about that. That is horrific to think about.
I was on my floor in my room crying to this anxious God. Literally just like, mate, like, I don't want to, please leave me alone.
Yeah.
Like, and then I looked at myself and I'm like, how nice is it I can say, oh yeah, I feel anxious because I drank a lot of alcohol last night, I had a few cigarettes and my heart was racing, so I naturally got a bit worried and I had a lack of sleep and
you know why early.
And it's like that awareness is like, mate, that's the most, you're like, yeah, I'll cross this line in my comfort zone and like I'm a bit fearful without having that panic attack again. You're not like, I think there's something wrong with me, what's going on? You're like, do you know what I mean? Because back then, that's what we were like.
It's all about attitude, man.
Because I didn't speak about it back in the day really because I didn't really know what was going on. But now I'm like to you right here on the podcast, literally saying, yeah, so my sleep last night was affected because this, and this.
It's about attitude.
How sick is that, though?
People often ask me when I tell them, the first thing, people, when they meet me, are very shocked that I have agoraphobia.
Yeah.
Because they go, oh, you don't seem like the sort of person who would have that.
Same for me. It's people say about me as well.
And I always say, it's because of my attitude.
Yeah, entirely.
I'm the biggest optimist. Yeah. And you can't learn to be an optimist. You either are or aren't.
You can't really force it.
But you can help yourself become an optimist.
Yeah, entirely, mate.
And I'm always like, you know, yes, I can't go on holiday, but I can do X, Y, Z.
You are very optimistic about it. Because when I first met you,
you're
like, yeah, I'm a Valium right now. I feel a bit anxious. I'm like, wait, what? I wasn't used to that. Because normally it's been like, my friends actually was like, a lot of them were like, I'm really anxious, don't know what to do. You were always just like, yeah, I feel a bit anxious. Like, oh, you're right, mate. I'm like, what? Like, you were so upbeat about it almost.
You got to own it.
Yeah. Yeah, mate. That's for everything in life.
Yeah.
But I think at the end of the day, mate, like, again, us having this chat now, some people will be like, this is pretty fucking deep. But that's the point.
Yeah, it's the point.
Because this should be a normal thing.
It should be normalised.
Me and you have talked about this kind of shit for years.
Yeah.
I sat down at the pub for you, back in the drinking days.
Yeah.
And I was like, how you feeling? You'd be like, yeah, you know, I feel a bit this, and I'd be like, yeah, I feel a bit suicidal. If the table next to us would have heard our conversation, they would have been like, who the hell are these boys?
Yeah, yeah.
But I kind of, that should be a, yeah. I want to get to that point where you can like walk past a random stranger and be like, are you all right?
Yeah.
And they can say, I don't feel very good.
Yeah.
And you don't say, what, you got a bit under the weather. You can say like, what's happening? Are you okay? Like how, like as in like, how are you feeling? Like feeling. Yeah. I want that to be a normal conversation.
I think we'll get there eventually.
Hope so.
There's a lot of masculinity involved in it.
Yeah, entirely. But let's wrap it up here because we're going to go on for, we can go on for like 10 hours, mate. I mean, let's just wrap it up here. It's a nice Saturday.
That's fine with me.
Let's go have a nice, little afternoon, shall we? And it's been insightful, man. Thanks for coming on as well. I do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Sorry if I rambled a bit.
Mate, you got to ramble sometimes, mate. I ramble all the time, geez. Don't worry there, right? Anyway, lots of love, mate. Thanks for coming on.
Cheers.